What's going on? It is Adam. Welcome back to Bringing It Backwards, a podcast where both legendary and rising artists tell their own personal stories of how they achieved stardom. On this episode, we hung out with Michael from Easy Star All Stars over Zoom video. Michael was born in West Virginia and raised in New York. He talks about how he got into music. Michael started playing guitar and writing songs at a very early age. In high school, at 15, he was already playing CBGBs and other iconic clubs in New York with his high school band. The band broke up when it came time to go to college. Everyone said they're going to stay in New York, but a couple of the members did not do that. So Michael started other projects. One of those projects ended up becoming Easy Star All Stars, which actually started out as Easy Star Records. And Easy Star All Stars was the house band for the albums. Michael talks about producing and releasing the Dub Side of the Moon album, where they did their own interpretation of the entire Dark Side of the Moon record by Pink Floyd. And they continue to do this for Radiohead OK Computer with their album Radio Dread. They did a Beatles record, Easy Star's Lonely Hearts Dub Band, and Michael Jackson's Thriller, Easy Star's Thriller. Michael also talks to us about the new album that they're doing, which is their reimagined rendition of David Bowie's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. It's called Ziggy Stardub. So he talks about that album and the amazing people that are on the record as well. People like Maxi Priest and Macy Gray and Steel Pulse, Fishbone. So Michael goes into the details of the new album, Ziggy Stardub, as well. You can watch our interview with Michael on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards. It'd be amazing if you subscribe to our channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Bringing Back Pod. And if you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple Music, Google Podcasts, it would be amazing if you follow us there as well and hook us up with a 5-star review.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're bringing it backwards with Easy Star All Stars.
And there's a lot of great music out there that's not produced by me. You know, I'm only one producer, and there are many great producers out there and great artists. So it's wonderful now that we can put out music that's made by so many different people.
Amazing. Well, I'm Adam. Nice to meet you. Thanks for
Me. I'm Michael. Nice to meet you too.
Awesome. So yeah, I always start off where talking about where were you born and raised?
Okay, I was born in Bluefield, West Virginia, like most Jewish reggae producers. I primarily grew up in New York City.
Which was
great for my musical education.
Sure. How long were you in Virginia?
West
Virginia.
That's all right. Just 3 years. I mean, I don't even remember it. You know, memories I have are probably from hearing stories from my parents, and then I think that I remember them, but I really don't.
So. Got it. So three, you had moved to New York.
No, we took a little stop in Chicago for a few years. I moved to New York when I was 7. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most of your life that it's in New York City. Yeah, I have a 6-year-old, almost 7. So I don't think he lived in San Diego for like 3 years or so. That's where I'm originally from.
Oh,
and
cool.
We're in Nashville now. But yeah, it's interesting. I guarantee he won't remember any of those years in San Diego.
I love San Diego. Whereabouts in San Diego were you?
I grew up in the Poway, Penasquitos area, but I spent a lot of my time and I lived in like South Park, North Park area, fairly close to like Pacific Beach.
Cool.
Yeah. I did actually radio in San Diego. I've come from radio originally. So I was on the radio in San Diego and in San Francisco, and I used to do a show called Wake and Break. And we used to play your guys' songs a lot. It was all reggae for like, I think it was 3 hours on a Sunday morning.
Nice. That's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's how actually I found out about your band. But so moved to New York. Do you come from a musical household at all?
Well, yeah, I come from a very musical household, but not of musicians. Well, like my paternal grandmother was a classical pianist and a music teacher. But she and I didn't have much of a relationship. You know, like she never taught me anything.
Music. Okay.
But both my parents, while not being musicians, love music, and I grew up listening to music, you know, from prenatally, I'm sure, but all different kinds of music, from a young age, I wasn't thinking about genres. I just thought of things as music. You know, like I tell this story that as a child, I didn't really know there was a difference between Mary Had a Little Lamb and Mysterioso by Thelonious Monk. They were just melodies I knew, you know. That's the way I wish it could be that way for kids and adults, which is just there's music you like, music you don't happen to like, music you've heard, music you haven't heard yet, but genre doesn't really have to be this, it's this artificial construct that society and the record industry and radio puts on us, but it's not always very helpful. It can be helpful to find other things. You're like, oh, I like this reggae song, let me check out some more reggae. But when people get into this, like, I only listen to this, or I don't listen to that because it's different, then I think that's against human nature.
No, I completely agree. I almost kind of feel like now, as you know, the internet has blown up, and with apps like TikTok and Instagram Reels and all that stuff, I feel like obviously there's genre specific, but I feel like it's more eclectic as far as like people's listening habits. Whereas like when I was growing up, I liked like punk music, so I was like, I'm only going to listen to punk rock music because that's what I like. Like it was hard for me to be like, I admit that I liked other artists, and in the sense of like, I didn't think it was cool to like so and so. But nowadays, you look at festival lineups. I mean, especially with like Coachella, it's like you have Beyonce as a headliner, and then all these other genres all kind of mashed in, and it's people like it's okay to like a whole broad, yeah, you know, spectrum of artists.
Right.
And I think that's changed a bit in the past 20 years or so. But I was going to say, so what was the first then instrument you got into?
Well, I used to fool around with the piano. There was one at my grandparents' house, and then we got one at my house. But interestingly, my sister, who did not grow up to be a musician, took piano lessons. I never did. I don't even remember if my parents were like, hey, do you want to take piano lessons? Or I was just like, I just wasn't into the idea of taking any kind of lessons, but I would just fool around on it, just coming up with melodies and exploring harmony. And then when I was in seventh grade, I was like 12 or 13, I had a good friend who was taking guitar lessons, and I would go over to his house, and he had a couple guitars, and I started just kind of learning some stuff. I took a few lessons, but I wasn't really feeling it because I think often, well, part of it was my fault for being an impatient 13-year-old. And I was like, I want to play the cool stuff now. And I didn't necessarily want to put in the time to learn the instrument well.
Okay.
So that's on me. But also the teacher that my parents found was a very nice guy, but he was from the school of thought, like you have to learn to play green sleeves before you can play anything else, you know? So I didn't last too long taking lessons. I took a few more over the course of my teenagehood, but it was really more just learning on my own, or learning from my friend who was taking lessons. But early on, I know I'm just like going off on your question.
No, that's what I want to hear.
Yeah, okay. But early on, I realized that while I did like playing guitar, but I didn't want to concentrate on like woodshedding for hours a day to learn how to play like some other guitarist. What I wanted to do was use the guitar as a vehicle for writing songs. And so by the time I wrote some pretty terrible songs when I was really young. By the time I was 15 or so, I was really taking it seriously, the idea of crafting good songs, both lyrically, melodically, harmonically. And I was in a band, and we used to play. And so you could write a song and then test it out on an audience that week, it would be rare to write a song and then premiere it that night because, you know, the band has to rehearse it and really get it good. But the idea is that you can have a creative idea, develop it a bit, and then get feedback immediately from from an audience. Now, granted, sometimes our audience was relatively small, but even so, you know, just one person saying, I really like that song could make you think I should develop that song even more. And growing up in New York City was amazing because in the mid 80s, when I was starting to play, for whatever reason, they were a little lax with things like letting minors into bars and clubs.
Oh, sure, to play.
So my band, we were all 15, and we would play at clubs around New York City.
Wow.
And which I guess was illegal, but all those clubs are gone now, so no one's getting in trouble. Yeah, but it was a great experience to be able to, and it was exciting too. You know, we weren't just like, okay, we're a high school band, we're just going to play at high school dances and in our garage. You know, this was like, we're playing at CBGB's, which was like the most famous club.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You were playing there at 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, this wasn't too, you know, I could even, I've, since I was young, I've been a bit of a music history nerd. You know, like I love learning about history, even bands or styles of music that I'm not really into, you know. So I was excited to play on the same stage where I knew, like, just a few years earlier, you know, the Talking Heads, and who I did like, and Blondie, who I liked, and the Ramones, who I didn't even really know the Ramones music much. No offense to all you punk lovers, like, but I just knew that that was a big thing, you know. Like, I knew the band Television had played there. I didn't know any Television's music, but I kind of felt like I was on this historic stage, you know, which I was, you know.
You were right, exactly.
So it was really great. Like, I can understand when kids come from, you know, smaller towns or suburbs, and they just feel kind of trapped because they have all this musical creativity and energy, and there's nowhere to express it. Whereas by growing up in New York City, I mean, I lived in Queens, which is one of the boroughs of New York City, but I played a lot in Manhattan. It was just exciting, and I really felt like I was part of something, you know. It was just, and maybe that's why I'm still doing it now, many decades later, because I just got caught up in this excitement and the idea that I could do this for my life, as a career, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to be playing like CBGBs, for example, at 15, I mean, to obviously, like you said, there's kids in the suburbs or small towns that would, you know, they don't have that type of experience, and they just want to get out and to play something like that would be amazing. But like, once you get that experience and you're able to, as a high school band, do those things, is it pretty, like, was it pretty clear early on that you're like, okay, this is what I want to do forever? Like, I have no, like, I don't want to go get a 9-to-5 job at one point. Like, I'm going to try to focus really on just making music a career for me.
You know, I don't think I thought it through so well.
Okay.
But I knew that I loved being able to write songs, sing them, have people care, or, you know, get attention from girls, which, you know, most teenagers, no matter what your gender identification is, you want some kind of attention from the people that you might be interested in, right? So it felt good. So I didn't have a master plan. I knew that I wanted to go to college. Well, the thing is, the four people in my band, we had all agreed, or so I thought, to stay in New York City. We're going to go to college, but we were staying in New York City. And the band would stay together. And two of us, including myself, did, but then two of the other guys decided to leave New York City, so the band was no longer. I guess that's kind of and I have no bad feelings towards the two guys who left. I mean, we're still friends, and I love them.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's an early lesson that I didn't internalize, which is that in the music industry, yes doesn't always mean yes. In fact, yes often means no.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you can't necessarily rely on what people say, you know, because it doesn't always come to pass. So,
sure. I'm just curious to know what did the band sound like that you had in high school? Is it anything like what you're doing now?
Well, I would say if I listened back to some of our live recordings, or even we made, you know, some pretty decent quality demos, I would probably say we sounded, you know, not great in the sense that, like, now I have so much more experience.
Right, of course.
In my 10,000 hours plus now. But we were eclectic. We definitely, you know, I mean, anything we liked, we would play or combine. So we had songs that were, you know, reggae or ska, definitely rock, influenced by pop music, R&B, jazz. We liked a lot of different music. You know, like we covered James Brown in a set, and then but then we would do, you know, an original ska song, you know, things like that. We just wanted to make music.
Sure. Oh, I mean, like, it's with Easy Star also, just like, you guys do Beatles records and Pink Floyd to Radiohead, and, you know, now the Bowie albums, or Michael Jackson. Like, it sounds like, I mean, to be able to even back then do a James Brown song and then kind of do something modern, it's just, you have a really good sense of being able to take artists and songs that wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't imagine to be in that genre, that style, and make it work.
Yeah, because like I said at the beginning of our conversation, when it comes down to it, it's all just music.
Sure. You
know, song is a good song, no matter what you do with it. I mean, I guess you could ruin it, but I think...
Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Ruin that song for everyone. No, but, and, you know, some people may have accused me of doing that with something, you know. Yeah, as long as the song is great and the performance is great, then genre... It could be any genre, you know, and still appeal to people.
At what point do you start Easy Star Ulcers, or when does this band get together? Was that quite a few years later after,
yes,
like, your, you know, your band, the high school band, obviously stops, and then the two you do, the you and the other person that was in the band, do you guys continue on? Like, do you try to get new members and keep that band together, or like, what's kind of the next phase of your music journey?
Well, so starting in college, myself and the other person in the band who stayed in New York, we started a new band.
Okay.
That band only lasted for a year, for our freshman year of college. And then my friend who was in the band, he decided to stop doing music as a career. You know, he went into something else. And now he's actually very successful in journalism. But it's actually still, it's instrumental to the history of Easy Star All-Stars, because the drummer that we have found for that band, his name is Franz Hilaire, he went on to be the very first drummer for Easy Star All-Stars.
Oh, wow.
But there's a period in between. So Franz and I founded a new band, and which lasted for, I'd say, 5 years. And we started out basically doing reggae and then R&B. Those were two musics that we both really loved, and I still love. As a side note, like, people think of me as the reggae guy, a lot of people do, but really I'd say R&B is my favorite music. I just happen to have become very successful doing reggae. Okay. So Franz and I started this band. We were called Special Request, which reggae fans will understand is a term in that reggae DJs will use. So that's why we named it that. And we did reggae and R&B and funk and like half and half. I mean, there was no rhyme or reason to it. We loved those genres. We recruited other people to be in the band. But at a certain point, we got a manager who was like, look, you guys got to focus on one genre. I guess it always comes down to that, right? So,
right.
So we chose R&B. We stopped doing reggae. Didn't stop liking reggae, but we stopped doing reggae. At that point, I can't remember what point, but then our keyboardist left, and my friend from high school, we didn't go to the same high school, we were friends back at that age, who was in another band who would play at CBGB's and in our general scene, who we were still friends with. He, an amazing keyboardist, his name is Victor Axelrod. He's also known as Tikla.
That's cool.
He joined our band, Special Request. Also important because he was another early member of Easy Star All Stars. So Special Request broke up in like 1996. We had actually started to get pretty successful. We were opening for big artists. We had some big offers, but there was just internally stuff going on and we broke up. And it was kind of devastating for me because that's what I thought my life was going to be. I thought, I'm going to make this into something really big. I was writing all these songs that I really thought were great. I was learning how to produce. I was getting better and better as a musician. But we broke up. And meanwhile, I was living in Manhattan with one of my friends, Lem Oppenheimer. And I was also hanging out a lot with two other friends from the high school days, Rami Gerstein and Eric Smith. And we would hang out and go listen to reggae, go to reggae shows. And at one point we were like, you know, there's not a lot of reggae coming out right now that we love. And we like dancehall, but there wasn't a lot of more traditional roots reggae made with, you know, in an analog style with musicians as opposed to using, you know, drum machines and, you know, synthesizers, and coming out of Jamaica, there wasn't a lot of that. And the reggae that was coming out of the US at the time seemed like a lot of it was just kind of like white guys who considered themselves Rastas and grew dreadlocks and did like bad Bob Marley copy music. I hope I'm not offending anyone with this.
Well, yeah, so, truth hurts, I guess, sometimes.
So we just thought at some point, why don't we just try to do this ourselves? Why don't we start a record label that's going to make the reggae music that we think is crucial? And that's how we started Easy Star. We each put in $1,000 and we got, you know, some friends and family to kick us a little money too. We spent the first almost, I'd say, year of our existence just researching how do you have a reggae label? What do you do? You know, how do you have a record label? How do you, you know, we consulted with other people that we knew who were a little higher up on the chain than us. We somehow got lists of like people who did reggae radio all over the world. We had this huge list. And then we just set about contacting these people, like, because we didn't know if these people still had their shows or not. We'd call some phone number. This isn't pre-internet, but this is before internet became a big thing. Like, I don't even think I had an email address when we were doing this, you know. But so I was calling some college radio station and whatever in Idaho and, you know, trying to get in touch with this name of some guy that might have been on this list that was totally outdated. So we were just trying to make sure, like, if we're going to be communicating with DJs, we knew who they were. Meanwhile, I was writing reggae tracks and songs, and then we were trying to recruit artists to sing on them. I'm gonna get to the answer to your question, which is
This is awesome. Again, this is about you and your story, so I love just listening to how this all kind of came, you know, how it all unfolded.
So once I had written, and I guess we knew we wanted to put out an album that we probably would be a compilation of singles. So we started just recording singles. So we found some artists that we liked and I worked out songs with them. And then we started recording, you know, song by song, or sometimes we do a session just for economic reasons. We try to do two songs in one session, you know, just to hire the musicians for one longer session, things like that. Mm-hmm. And the very first song we did, the only musicians who played on it were myself and Franz Hilaire from Special Request and Victor Axelrod from Special Request. So that was like the first iteration of the Easy Star All-Stars. I played all the guitars and bass. Franz played drums. Victor played keys. I think on this one, it was piano and organ. The song was called Anything for Ja. The artist was Rob Simeon, who's still active. Great guy. That was our first, I don't think that was actually our first recording, but that was our first single that we put out. And then, you know, we're recording more and more songs. It's not always the same musicians every time, because sometimes I think on our first album, Victor and I played on everything, but there were different drummers. Sometimes I brought in different bassists so I could just concentrate on guitar, horns. We had just a big group of revolving cast musicians, and we thought for branding purposes, so we have Easy Star Records, and we thought it would be great to have the name of the band, the house band, reflect the name of the label for marketing and branding. So we figured it's an all-star cast of musicians from the New York reggae scene. How about we call it the Easy Star All-Stars, which we did. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes I regret that because many people get the name of the band wrong. I'd say more often than not, people are like, hey, are the Easy Dub All-Stars or the Easy All-Stars or East Star All-Stars. Why did we do that? But for better or for worse, we are the Easy Star All-Stars. That was the house band. And then we never performed live until 1998. We had a release party for our very first album, Easy Star Volume 1, which you still find on DSPs. And there are physical copies out there somewhere, too. Or you could buy them from the EasyStar.com store. For that release show, you know, I put together a version of the Easy Star All-Stars, and we backed up many of the artists who sang songs on the album, and it was a tremendous success. It was insane, actually. I feel like we played for many, many hours. I feel like the show started at 9 and finished at 2 or 3 or something like that. And breaks, but because we backed up every art, maybe I'm exaggerating. It was a long time ago, 1998, 25 years ago. But it was pretty amazing. And then moving forward, we weren't doing a ton of recording, but we did a bunch of live shows in, say, 1999, 2000, 2001, all in New York City. Again, somewhat of a rotating cast of musicians, but it was always myself and Victor on keys. And we did some great stuff, like some of my favorite gigs, actually. We backed up Sugar Minot, who's one of my favorite singers, who Easy Star did a lot of work with, and he passed away. I mean, I feel like I just talked to him, but he passed away almost 13 years ago, which is wild.
Wow.
That was one of my favorite shows ever because it wasn't even my idea, but the idea was to do a show where he featured music from his first few solo albums. And then we also did some of his later hits. And he, for whatever reason, he didn't even come to our rehearsal. But we knew the songs. I think we played the shit out of them, and we had a little horn section. But Sugar couldn't remember the lyrics to a lot of his old songs because these are songs from the late 70s, early 80s. So we're on stage, I'm playing and having to mouth the words to him sometimes.
Yeah, like feed the line to him.
Yeah, feed the line to him. And he's a singer, you know, I grew up, he's one of my favorite reggae singers. And it was just it was so funny, but also just so amazing. You know, we were in this club in New York City on 14th Street, off of Washington Avenue. It was in the meatpacking district. It was this club called The Cooler, and it was underground. It used to be a meat cooler for a meatpacking company. Like relatively low ceilings, and it was just hot and sweaty. It was packed. I don't know how many people could fit in there. You know, it wasn't huge, maybe like 300 or 400 people playing songs that I absolutely loved with the singer who sang them, even if he couldn't remember all the words. So we did stuff like that. We backed up Johnny Osborne, another in the same club, same similar situation, another amazing reggae singer who's still quite active. We did a few tributes to Augustus Pablo, who's one of my favorite musicians and producers who had passed away in 1999, I believe. So we did a few tribute shows to him. We did a tribute show to Dennis Brown, another one of my favorite singers who passed away in 1999, bad year. We just did a bunch of really fun shows. But then the Easy Star All-Stars, as most people know them, didn't really come into being until we did Dub Side of the Moon, which is still, I'd say, our most famous album, although I'd love to eclipse it, pardon the pun, with our new album, Ziggy Stardub. My aforementioned partner, Lem Oppenheimer, was a big Pink Floyd fan. And he told me in high school he used to listen to side, I can't remember which side, I'm going to say side two of Dark Side of the Moon, like every day for one semester of high school. That was just his thing. Now, I didn't know the album that well. I knew all the big songs. You can't grow up in the United States hearing radio and going to parties and stuff like that, not ever hear Money, you know.
Right. Exactly.
So, but I didn't really know it as an album. You know, I never really sat down and just listened to it. So Lem was listening to it one day and he just thought, you know, this would be kind of cool if we did it over as a dub or reggae, you know? So he brought the idea to the rest of the partners, myself, Eric, Ramey, and of the four partners, I'm the only one who was and is a musician and a producer.
Everyone else is just that helped form the label's business.
They handle the business, marketing. Sure. Obviously, they're very essential to Easy Star.
Yeah, right, definitely.
But I was the only music guy, you know, who actually can make music. So it was kind of on me to listen to this stuff and think, what could we do with it? And honestly, I was a little skeptical at first. First of all, I didn't get into doing reggae and starting co-founding a record label to do covers of rock music. It just had never occurred to me. And I just thought, yeah, this is just weird, you know? But I sat in my little bedroom studio and I came up with a basic arrangement for Breathe, the first song on Dark Side of the Moon. And I thought, you know what, this kind of works. You know, like, in fact, the if you listen to Dub Side of the Moon now, what you're hearing is basically the arrangement I wrote in my bedroom when we first were like, hey, let's try doing a reggae version of this, you know? So I did that, and maybe I checked out one other song, and I went back to the guys. I was like, you know what, I think this could work. You know, mm-hmm. So I enlisted Victor Axelrod to co-produce it with me, and he had his own studio in his basement. He still does, which was pretty important because then we could record a lot of stuff there, as opposed to my bedroom studio at the time. We recorded the basic tracks to one-inch tape, 16-track one-inch tape, at another studio in Mount Vernon, New York, which is north of the city. There's a great record store in Manhattan called Jammyland, which was like one of the preeminent reggae record stores in the world. Like, people would come from all over the world to go to Jammyland to get like rare vinyl. The owner of Jammyland, Ira Heaps, he had a studio in his mom's basement. A lot of basements going on here. And he invited us to come up and record the basic tracks up there. So we did. And then, Victor and I spent a lot of time just figuring out what the arrangements would be. We worked as a team really, really well. I mean, sometimes some songs were more him, some songs were more me, and some songs were really just, you know, complete collaboration. Over the course of a few years, because we were both hustling, doing other jobs, both music and non-music, we would just, you know, hey, let's do a session, you know, next Monday. And I'd go to his house and we'd work on a song. And then once we had all the music pretty settled, we started recruiting singers. And this got really interesting because most of these Jamaican singers had no idea who Pink Floyd was, let alone what Dark Side of the Moon was. Mm-hmm. So they came at it with a very different perspective than if you ask someone who grew up steeped in it, which was great. And then maybe that's one of the reasons why I was able to co-produce it the way I did, was because I wasn't thinking about the important history of the album and what it meant to people too much. I knew it was an important album and I knew people really cared about it, but I just wanted to make a good reggae version of it. Mm-hmm. So we recruited singers and somehow got them through these, you know, sometimes challenging songs for someone who doesn't know them. And then once we had all the vocals down, you know, we made a decision to not have guitar solos on the album. We just wanted it to be as like hardcore reggae as possible. So instead we got permission from the publishers, which is a whole other story of how to do this.
Oh yeah. I'm sure that was a nightmare, especially with like the records you guys went after and have done.
Well, I'm not going to say it was a nightmare, but
okay. I mean,
okay, let me address that and I'll get back to say, which is that we weren't sure there is, if you want to cover music, which people do every day, you can get something called a compulsory mechanical license, which means you can cover anything as long as you pay the royalties. And I'm not going to get into what mechanical royalties mean. It's too complicated. But and there's a statutory rate that you have to meet per song, and longer songs you pay more, things like that. But in the rules around that, there's what we found to be a gray area legally. It said, like, you can get a compulsory mechanical license without actually having to do anything, just by virtue of recording the song and then paying the royalties, but not if you make a fundamental change to the composition. Mm. Now, what does a fundamental change to the composition entail? No one's ever actually explained that. So we thought, and our lawyer advised, like, look, this is a gray area. Like, by making it into reggae, are you fundamentally changing it? Maybe. So we decided to do everything above board, which I know is very un-music business and un-reggae of us. And we went to the publishers, and they were actually pretty supportive of the project. And they also said, we asked them, if we add lyrics by taking Jamaican DJs and having them do a chat where, say, a guitar solo had been, is that okay? And they said, we need to approve it, but hypothetically, you could do that. So we rolled the dice on recording this stuff, although I actually also recorded the guitar solos, which was very interesting for me, like trying to learn note for note David Gilmour's solos. And they actually did wind up approving these additional lyrics, which was great, because that's, I think, one of the best parts of Dub Side of the Moon to me is having Dollar Man and Ranking Joe doing their chats on these songs. So we worked with the publishers. We also engaged with Pink Floyd's management. And now, as some people know, there was a rift in Pink Floyd where Roger Waters, who was one of the founders and songwriters and the bassist for Pink Floyd, he left Pink Floyd, and the other guys were still Pink Floyd, and they weren't the best of friends, and they're still not the best of friends. They even made news like last week, Roger Waters and David Gilmour fighting. So we had to deal with two sets of publishers and two sets of management, but somehow we worked it all out. So everything's recorded, and then Victor and I mixed it at his home studio, and that was really fun. And, you know, a lot of times, like, to do the dub effects, it would be both of us with both of our hands on the board at the same time, just moving, you know, okay, you take those things, I'll take these things. This is how it used to be done, and, you know, it wasn't all in a computer. And, you know, so we mixed it. We had a friend master it who wasn't even, like, a professional mastering engineer, but he obviously did a good job. And then we put it out, and we hired a PR company because we couldn't just get it out there on our own. We had a distributor, and it started to take off. You know, people really responded to it. And many people had been skeptical because they, I see we're already a little, I don't know how long you want this to be, but it's already like 37 minutes past we started, and I don't know if this is, I'm going too long. You tell me.
Oh, you're not. No, it's fine. No, there's no time limit unless okay. You have to go.
Yeah, I should go in about 15, 20 minutes. But anyway,
yeah, that works.
I'm going to speed through 20 years of history. Anyway.
No, for sure.
So look, some people were skeptical. Fans of Pink Floyd thought that they would hate Dub Side of the Moon. We actually won a lot of them over. And my main point is that we got people who didn't like reggae, or who never listened to reggae, or who even said they hated reggae, to then become reggae fans. Mm-hmm. And we got reggae fans who didn't even know Pink Floyd to become Pink Floyd fans. So we're really, it's very important to me personally, and I think to Easy Star as a label, to break down barriers, but these artificial barriers between people. It's one of the first things I mentioned in our conversation, you know, is the artifice of the radio and the music industry and society and saying, no, you are this, you are not that. And with Dub Side of the Moon, we were able to break down barriers, which we continue to do with our other records. So I feel really good about that.
Yeah, I mean, with the success of Dub Side of the Moon, do you feel like moving forward, you're like, okay, people receive this, they get what we're doing, so we can take on, I mean, I said earlier, it's like, you know, taking on Thriller and, you know, Sgt. Pepper's and even like the Radiohead records that you guys did with OK Computer, like, those albums are like so they're huge and they're so meaningful to people. And then to take your own version of them that people still love, right? I mean, that's do you feel like it was kind of like, okay, let's roll the dice and see. It worked with Pink Floyd. Will it work with Radiohead? Or was it just like, we love Radiohead, we're going to do it. Well, hopefully people care.
No, it's more the former. We realized we did something successful. We understood the reasons why. And we thought we'd try to replicate it. As the producer and the arranger, I try to grow with every album in some direction. Mm-hmm. So I never want them to be like, oh, that sounds just like your last album, you know. And with Radio Dread, our version of OK Computer, another thing is that Victor Axelrod, although, I mean, we're still friends, but he decided to stop being an Easy Star All-Stars and stop co-producing. So only the Dub Side of the Moon was the only album that he was that involved with, although he did come back and play he did play a couple things on Radio Dread, and he played on Easy Star's Lonely Hearts Dub Band. What was my point? Okay, so for Radio Dread, I realized, okay, over half the song, I think 7 of the 12 songs on OK Computer are either not in 4/4 time or like go back and forth between 4/4 time and other time signatures. One, like Paranoid Android changes time signatures 13 times. Like,
oh, wow.
So like that kind of stuff is not typical for reggae. I think we kind of cracked the code with Money from Dub Side of the Moon, which is in 7/4 time. So, you know, it was a great challenge to try to figure out how to make all these songs work that shouldn't work. But it was great because I think I became adept at it, and now it's not that big a deal for me to handle translating songs in weird time signatures. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, and we knew that Radiohead were fans of Dub Side of the Moon, so that helped.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so that was cool. And yeah, so then we just kept choosing albums that we thought, well, also all of us, but I think myself maybe the most, like, I really care about albums, you know. I want to, it doesn't have to be a concept album per se, but I love an album that takes you on a journey and that the songs kind of make sense as a whole. And that if you're listening to it on vinyl, which is my preferred way to listen to music, that you take one journey on side A, then you flip it over and you take another journey on side B. But together they make one bigger journey. Mm-hmm. So I want all of our albums to be some kind of journey. And so we're not going to ever do a greatest, well, I can't say never. So far we have not done a greatest hits, you know, like everyone's like, oh, do the Eagles greatest hits. And yeah, there are great songs on there, but to me it's not an album in the way that I want to listen to an album. It's a collection of songs. So mm-hmm. we're trying to do albums that were conceived to be a piece of work, a piece of art even, and then try to make our own reinterpretation of that, which I hope we've been successful at doing.
Yeah. No, I love that, because like you said, I was kind of curious about that, but you answered my question, where instead of going into, okay, we're going to choose Michael Jackson, we're going to do all the hits, it's we're going to select a specific record and do it all the way through front to back.
Yes, exactly. My, if I was to distill it down to just one sentence of how I approach these albums, and now try to keep track if this is actually one sentence or not, what would it be like if the artists from the original album had recorded that album in Jamaica in, say, the late 70s, early 80s? You know, the same songs, but that's where they recorded and that's what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I, you know, kind of my, it's not a hard and fast rule, but it kind of helps me get comfortable with the idea in these dealing doing these albums.
Mm-hmm. With Easy Star Records, you talk about being kind of like the house band for these artists. At obviously, you've signed your down the line. I mean, and released, Revolution Records and the Green, like the Skins, and like some of these big albums and these big artists. At what point was it okay? We'll be the house band for a while, but then this band's putting out a great record. We should just sign the whole project.
Yeah. Well, I mean, pretty early on, our very full length release after Easy Star Volume 1 was an album by the Jamaican harmony trio, The Meditations.
Mm-hmm.
Meadow Knowledge, great album, great artists.
Yeah, I wasn't sure on that album if you guys had helped at all as far as production and
yeah, there was one song that I produced on it that has I guess you could say a version of the Easy Star All Stars on it. The rest of it was produced by them. And then when we started working with Sugar Minot, we were getting stuff. He had all the stuff from the vaults that had either never been released at all or at least never been released on CD. So we started working with him. So we really branched out to doing some in-house productions, but also licensing productions by other Jamaican artists, and then also doing older stuff that hadn't seen the light of day. And then, so now we've evolved into a company that primarily is licensing music that's not produced by me or by Easy Star All Stars or Easy Star Records, mm-hmm. but it's great because now, say for our new album, Ziggy Stardub, I spent a good part of over 2 years working on it because that's how I roll. Like I just get really into it and I'm, I'll spend probably way too long on like one little detail, that kind of thing. So there's only a limited, and of course I do other things as well during that time, but it's not easy to produce all, if we put out 7 albums in a year, there's no way I could produce 7 albums in a year.
Sure.
And there's a lot of great music out there that's not produced by me. I'm only one producer, mm-hmm. and there are many great producers out there and great artists. So it's wonderful now that we can put out music that's made by so many different people.
Right. And the selection of artists that you guys have signed over the course of the years is insane. Especially, in that genre. But coming from 15 years old and being in a band and playing CBGBs and starting really guitar as you said a vehicle to start writing and putting out your own songs, you Easy Star All Stars ended up doing a record of what of all your songs right at one point or with the Until That Day. Was that something that you had been working on, like a batch of songs? You're like, we should put this out like as our house band, but with songs that I had written, like a project of songs that I had written.
Well, actually, I did not write any of the songs on Until That Day.
Oh, you didn't? So, my bad.
No, that's okay. With Until That Day, okay, so we have the East Star All-Stars. It's not a conventional band in a way. In the studio, it's really kind of me and whomever I get together for that project, because that's what I feel is right for that project, that song, yeah. That album. But we also, because we became a popular live touring act, we had musicians who would tour as Easy Star All-Stars. I started out in the touring band, but then I wanted to concentrate on production. So I mm-hmm. left the touring band. The touring band continued without me. And there was, people would come and go from the touring band. There was, some people who've been in it for the most part over the last 20 years. There's some people, but there've been people who've been in the band for a few years and left, come back. There's people who are in and out, but it's a, a collective and of all really talented musicians who can, many of them who also write music. So we had been incorporating originals into our live set and we decided to record an EP of some of these originals, which is Until That Day. And then in 2011, we put out an album called First Light, which was a full album of originals written mm-hmm. by members of the touring band, and including myself. I have a couple of songs on there that I wrote and a few others that I co-wrote with other people in the band. because it's important to be able to express yourself creatively in that way, I think. And I think it's a great album. It's not as successful as our tribute albums, but I hope that anyone listening will check out First Light by Easy Star All Stars, and you'll hear some great tunes.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was sorry. I was just kind of, and I, you know, assuming because of the songwriting, and I'm like, oh, well, now it's Easy Star All Stars was your band, and you know, maybe.
Yeah, no, Adam, you, all don't worry about it, because many people assume that I don't even exist, and that the Easy Star All Stars is just this band that conceives of and produces all this music, you know. So
right,
I'm the man behind the scenes. I'm behind. If anyone's watching on Zoom on this podcast, you can see we're doing it on Zoom, and I'm behind a pop screen for my microphone. Like, you know, no one even knows what I look like, man. So it's nice for someone to assume I did more than I did instead of less. Anyway, Adam, I would really love to talk about our new albums again.
That's where I was going to jump into it right now. I was curious. You mentioned that it's been kind of a 2-year ride with this. Yeah. How did it start? Like, when did you decide on a Bowie and you know, doing this album?
Well, we had been considering Ziggy Stardust as an option probably since after Radio Dread. And for whatever reason, it wasn't our two choices after Radio Dread. But Ziggy Stardust is an album that I really loved as a teenager. In fact, someone reminded me that my high school band played the song 5 years at at some gig that I didn't even remember us doing, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when we were thinking about what's the next album going to be, and we hadn't put out an Easy Star All-Stars tribute album since Thrilla in 2012. It'd been a really long time. I'd been busy with a lot of other things. The label had been working with a lot of different artists. So at some point, we'd been banding about ideas, and we landed on Ziggy, and I felt pretty strongly about it as the one who would have to be arranging and producing it, that I felt like I could do a good job. So, you know, it hit the marks of being a real album that has some kind of cohesiveness to it with great songs, and that's iconic, and that I felt like I could translate into Jamaican music.
What would you say, like, because I've only heard the one that you've put out thus far, which is it's such a cool version, because I was curious to see how it would go. I mean, I love what you've obviously done with the past albums, and I'm like, okay, how are they going to approach Bowie? And even the vocal on it is so, it has that kind of like eerie sound to it, but it's not. It's hard to explain it. Like, it reminds me of Bowie, but it also doesn't. It's just a little bit different than what I would think of when I think of like a reggae record.
Cool. Well, that's great. We always want to be different. Well, the song you're referring to is Starman, which was the first single off of the original David Bowie album, and we also made it the first single off of ours. And with that one, I mean, the original is great. I decided to give it, I used this drum pattern. It's called Flying Cymbals, which was popularized in Jamaica in the mid-late 70s. By this drummer, Santa Davis, who actually, I think, may live in San Diego area now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's just got a very up full feel. Like, it's got a nice bounce to it. And I thought it would work well with the song, to just make the song a little more, I don't know, happy and joyful and a little less weird science fiction alien. And then Maxi Priest, as the vocalist, made a lot of sense to me. He's a great singer. I've been a fan since the 80s. He's British Jamaican, so that's always cool to, you know, have UK artists on an album that's a tribute to a UK artist. And he's just got a very distinctive sound. Like, I thought, you know, this is going to be like Maxi Priest singing David Bowie. It's going to sound like Maxi Priest. And then when we actually did it, I was like, wow, that sounds exactly how I imagined it. It's like this classic voice that I love, that's very distinctive, doing this song that I love. So it was really a great combination for me.
And you've had, I mean, the album, from what I've read about it, has like some amazing people on it. You know, aside from Maxi Priest, you have Macy Gray on the record, Steel Pulse, Fishbone. I mean, these iconic people. You know, tell me, like, where do they kind of fall in line? Is it you grab somebody for a specific song, on the album, or how did that work?
Yeah, often I'll have an idea. Like with Macy Gray, I just, for whatever reason, thought, you know what? She's going to sound great on Rock and Roll Suicide. It's just such an emotional song, and I think she could take it to a really great place, which she did, and everyone hopefully will agree. So now she is not from the reggae world, but mm-hmm. again, it's just music. So reached out to her through her management. Luckily, the drummer in her band, I've been playing with. I was recording and touring with the pop artist Jason Mraz for a few years.
Oh wow, and he's from San Diego. I don't know if he's from there, but he lived in San Diego.
He lives in that area. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so his drummer Tamir also plays with Macy Gray. I was like, hey, can you connect me with her management? He did. The manager, turns out, was a big fan of Radio Dread. And it was like, you know what? I want to make this happen. And so, you know, it took a long time, mm-hmm. But we did make it happen. And she interpreted the shit out of the song. so that was really great. And like getting Fishbone, I've loved Fishbone also since the 80s. I used to go see them at CBGB's, like probably pretty soon after their first EP dropped in like 85 or 86. Uh-huh.
They're such a rad band. I love seeing them.
And Easy Star All-Stars has done a bunch of shows with them. And so it was great to get them on it. And then there were some old stalwarts like Steel Pulse we worked with a few times, and I've become, you know, pretty close to those guys, and it was great to have them on the album doing 5 years, the song that I don't remember playing live, but apparently I did, 1986 or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great, great group of artists, diverse group of artists. There's a couple artists on there that we work with in other capacities on Easy Star Records, Sundub. They do the song Lady Stardust. It's their singer, Joanna Teeters, and we put out their album recently, really amazing stuff. We have Mortimer doing Soul Love and Samory I doing It Ain't Easy, and both of those artists, we've put out some stuff. We put out an EP with Mortimer a couple years ago, and we put out a single with each of them recently, and we have full albums from Mortimer and Samory I coming hopefully later this year. All really, really great stuff. So it's, you know, it's part of, it's about family. Like many of the artists on this album are just part of the Easy Star family already. So it just made sense for them to be singing with Easy Star All-Stars.
Yeah. I mean, like the Skints too, you put out their record.
Oh yeah. Skints are family. Great to have them on it. Jamie from the Skints is a big Bowie fan. So that was really cool to have him sing the song Ziggy Stardust. Yeah, it's really, I am a very much, I'm pretty self-critical, and I really, it's hard for me to listen to music that I've produced without thinking, oh, I could have done this, I could have done that, which I think is typical of many creators. But this album, I feel, and maybe I'm jinxing myself, although I don't believe in jinxes, that I feel like this is like the best version of my vision of what these albums could be. So I hope people will agree.
I can't wait to hear it, man. I'm really, one of my favorite Bowie songs is Severgin City. And then I saw that the Skints were on that one. So I was like, oh, that's awesome that they did that one. But to take on, I just have a couple more questions real quick. But I'm just curious, when you take on an album like, you know, Ziggy Stardust, is there a point in the album, like, is there a song that you get to, you're like, oh, like this is going to be like, was there a challenge? Like, what was the most challenging one to kind of interpret?
Well, I mean, they're all challenging in a way, because whatever I come up with has to be great. Like, people have to think it's great, you know?
Right, right. No, for sure. For sure.
So one challenge is that I spoke earlier about changing time signatures. Mm-hmm. And on this album, there are two songs, the first and last song, 5 Years and Rock and Roll Suicide, that are in 6/8 time. It's called waltz time, which is not typical of reggae. And for this album, I don't know, I just decided, instead of trying to make the reggae work with that, as I had in the past, I translated them to 4/4 time, which is, you know, I don't know how many musicians or people who understand music theory are listening or watching, but it's not so simple, but that was a pretty good challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting, okay, Hang On to Yourself. Boy, I really don't have much time, but I've got to tell this story. So Hang On to Yourself on the Bowie album supposedly was the inspiration for the programmer who programmed the preset rhythms on the Casio MT40 keyboard. She programmed something called the Rock preset, and it went kind of like, okay, now that was discovered by this Jamaican artist and producer, Wayne Smith, in 1985, when he was messing around with the Casio MT40. And that became the basis for a huge reggae rhythm called the Slang Tang rhythm. He had a song called Under Me Slang Tang, and it became, basically, that started the digital revolution in reggae. That's when reggae started changing to be something that is using drum machines and computers away from live musicians, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. That's what happened. And everyone was voicing on this rhythm. And when we were making this album, I thought, you know, I've got to make the connection. So I wound up taking the MT40 and playing, using it to play Hang On To Yourself by David Bowie, and then kind of creating the track around that, and then adding Fishbone to it, who are insane in the best way, you know, mm-hmm. like they're crazy vibes. Then I added Johnny Go Figure, who is the Jamaican DJ in the touring version of the E-Star All-Stars, to add some Jamaican toasting in there, and topping it off with my friend Vernon Reed from Living Color. He plays guitar on the track, which really brings it back home, because I remember seeing Fishbone and Living Color at CBGB's in like 1986 when I was
That's wild. All
together. So I hope everyone will check out Ziggy Stardub. It comes out, I don't know when this is going to air, but the album is out April 21st, 2023. Moon Age Daydream, the single, is dropping this Wednesday, tomorrow, the 22nd of February.
Awesome, yeah.
Whenever this is airing, it should be out already.
It'll be out for sure.
Yeah, so that's featuring Naomi Cowan, who's a great Jamaican singer.
Mm-hmm. I've had her on my show before.
Oh, she's great. Awesome.
Yeah.
So, Ziggy Stardub, we're going to be touring, hopefully, all over the world with it over the next couple of years, and I really appreciate all the support from all the people who've been listening for all this time.
I love it, man. Thank you so much. I have one more last quick question. I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists. I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, yeah, it's my pleasure. Advice for aspiring artists? If I was going to pick one thing, I would say learn the business as much as you hone your craft as an artist, whether you're just an artist or a songwriter or producer, but also really learn the business. Understand the music business, have realistic expectations. Doesn't mean you shouldn't shoot for the moon every time, but have realistic expectations, understand the business, surround yourself with good people, and remain ethical even when it's difficult. There, it's a bunch of little things all in one sentence.